Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Man, there's so much going on, but where do I start? First up, let's talk about George Zimmerman. And in fact, I posed the question, will George Zimmerman be another O.J. Simpson? You see, the American criminal justice system is a peculiar institution. In many ways, American people don't understand the criminal justice system, because it's not just about the crime. It is about the charges filed and what you can prove about the crime. Case in point. If you ask most Americans whether or not they thought Casey Anthony was guilty of killing her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee, most people would say yes. But yet, after 33 days of testimony, 400 pieces of evidence, and more than 90 witnesses, the jury found Casey Anthony not guilty of her charges of aggravated child abuse and aggravated manslaughter of a child. The O.J. Simpson trial is another example. And let me caveat. There are so many mixed views and mixed emotions about the O.J. Simpson verdict that if you would bring it up at a family gathering, you can almost be guaranteed some heated fellowship. Someone would be moving some furniture, I'm sure. At any rate, from the opening statements on January 24, 1995, to the not guilty verdict on October 3, 1995, emotions ran high. Many hateful remarks were spewed all over the world. But it wasn't about whether or not O.J. committed the crime. It was about whether or not he was convicted of the charges. Now, many people don't realize this about the verdict. President Bill Clinton was briefed on security measures if rioting occurred nationwide due to the O.J. Simpson verdict. And an estimated 100 million people worldwide stopped what they were doing to watch or listen to the verdict announcement. Long-distance telephone call volumes declined by 58%. And trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange by 41%. Water usage decreased as people avoided using bathrooms and government officials postponed meetings. So much work stopped that the verdict cost an estimated $480 million in lost productivity. Now, here we are, approximately 17 years later, and another major case is upon us. And similarly, at the end of the day, it would not be about the crime. It would be about the charges. We know George Zimmerman disobeyed the police orders not to pursue, and he hunted down Trayvon Martin with a loaded gun. We know George Zimmerman shot and killed an unarmed teenager. We know there is a lot more evidence in this case than ever was in the O.J. Simpson trial. Yet, we also know that at the end of the day, it would not be about whether or not George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin. It would be about whether or not they can prove the charges of the crime, second-degree murder. Now, I've been making comparison to the O.J. Simpson trial for quite some time now. It seems to me that others are starting to see the parallels. Here's one example. And in fact, there's an article by Jason Whitlock, and here's what he had to say. Someone tell Bill O'Reilly, Piers Morgan, Ann Coulter, and all the others don't rush the judgment. Innocent until proven guilty George Zimmerman defenders that the original TV media lynch mob hunted O.J. Simpson and birthed their million-dollar cable news platform. Yeah, long before Geraldo Rivera preached to Trayvon Martin's parents about the evils of hoodies, he sat on CNBC during the mid-1990s and led the media prosecution of O.J. Simpson. Geraldo was so good at it, and the American public so enamored by it, that smart TV executives quickly launched MSNBC and Fox News. To capitalize on the ratings, gold, Geraldo discovered. So forgive me for pointing out the obvious. At best, the whining about the left-wing media's passionate belief that Zimmerman should be arrested and charged with the crime and the death of Martin is embarrassingly hypocritical and delusional. At worst, it reveals an appalling racial bias. Now, there is a significant more evidence that Zimmerman committed a crime on February 26, 2012, than there ever was that Simpson committed one on June 12, 1994. The Trayvon Martin case isn't a whodunit. We don't have to speculate about motives or opportunity. We know who was carrying the gun and who was carrying the Skittles. We know who a police dispatcher advised to abandon pursuit. We know who was a 28-year-old wannabe cop complaining about effing coons and who was a 17-year-old boy talking to his girlfriend. It took 5 days for the police to arrest and charge O.J. Simpson, 36 days after police listed Martin as John Doe. John Simmons was a free man and apparently being elevated to martyrdom in some influence circles. Let me pause here and offer a few of my resume highlights as a way to clarify and authenticate my perspective. I always thought O.J. was guilty of murder and stated that opinion in my writing at the time. I don't choose the positions I take or the people I support and defend based on race. Despite the nonsense you might read in the anonymous comments at the bottom of this or any column I write, I have a long, documented history of independent thought, especially when it comes to race. I supported the falsely accused white Duke lacrosse players before anyone else in the media. I traveled to Jenna, Louisiana, and wrote columns that properly framed the media exploited Jenna 6 story. I stood on an island calling BS on the overreaction to Don Imus, inflammatory comments about the Rutgers women basketball team. My critics think I'm a contrarian for attention. The truth is, I abhor groupthink, packed journalism, and unfairness, no matter the victim. I also believe the most effective way to fight unfairness is by maintaining consistency in logic and deed. I am far from perfect. My sense of humor oftentimes reveals my own struggle to be fair. Now, he goes on to say, many of you are bothered that Martin's murder was struck a strident chord with African Americans in a similar way Nicole Brown Simpson's murder hit white Americans. You're bothered by the Heat's symbolic hoodie photo. You're upset Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are back in the spotlight. You don't understand that in many American cities, minorities, even with a mountain of evidence stronger than the OJ case, are routinely forced to protect for justice in their streets to get their constitutional promise day in court. You're tired of the story being shoved down your eyes by seemingly every TV network. Privilege has made you ignore the consequences of the 18-month-long OJ marathon that created this style of TV journalism. Not me. The chickens have come home to roost. That is not gloating. That is not satisfaction. I agree that George Zimmerman needs to be treated fairly, but so do Trayvon Martin's family, friends, and loved ones. They need Zimmerman's account of events heard before a judge and jury, not a group of overworked, Zimmerman-sympathetic police officers late at night. If your child never returned home from a trip to get candy and iced tea because a 250-pound grown man suspected he was a burglar, you would want some very difficult questions answered in the court of law, not on a street corner or inside a police interrogation room. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. What do you think? Could Zimmerman possibly get away with murder based on the charges filed against him? I need you to weigh in. It's time to take a quick break. But when we return, we're going to open up the phone lines and hear from you. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, Tailor-Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and AskGema can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, AskGema. And AskGema says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I wanted to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. In just a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. But before we do that, joining me live in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of TaylorMade Training and Consulting. I introduce the some and present the others, no other than Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, first off, will George Zimmerman be another O.J. Simpson?
No, he will not be another O.J. Simpson.
And why not?
Well, for one reason, we know he did it. The case with O.J. was they was trying to decide if he did it, and somebody had to prove that he did it. The difference here is that we know George Zimmerman did it. The issue is whether or not he was within the law in doing it, whether or not the stand your ground law applies, or whether or not it was a, you know, self-defense and they fought and he defended himself or whatever. So either way, it's a matter of not what he did in terms of killing Trayvon, but whether or not he was justified in killing Trayvon. So that's why I don't think it would be another O.J.
Okay, so let me simplify it. Now, we don't know. We'll never know if O.J. killed Nicole Simpson or not. We won't know that. Right? But we do know that Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin. Abundant amount of evidence. It took 5 days for them to arrest O.J., but it took them over a month to get Zimmerman. Now, he's been charged with this second-degree murder charge, right? It may be a good possibility he be found not guilty of those charges, which means that, again, he gets off. He's found non-guilty for killing somebody.
Right, but I think the thing there is that the case would be hinging around not whether or not he killed Trayvon, but whether or not he was justified in the killing. So there's a degree of different things that can happen. It could be murder, too, but I believe if this goes to jury, I don't think it's going to go to a jury trial myself. I think somewhere along the line he's going to have a plea. He's going to make a plea, and a plea to something, and I don't think it's ever going to go to jury trial. I just don't think so. Now, that's just the rule according to Jima. But let's say it does go to a jury trial, then, you know, it's not just murder, too, but it's also manslaughter. And so he may get a lesser charge in terms of murder, too. He may do some time. He may not do as there's no amount of time will be enough unless it's life, excuse me, without parole for some. If he gets, you know, manslaughter, it could be 5 to 10 years or something like that, out in 5 with good behavior. So that's not going to ever seem like enough time to a lot of people. And so there's a degree of charges, and he was charged with murder too, but there's a range there once it goes to trial in terms of what the jury will be instructed to look for based on the burden of proof that comes out. So, you know, based on that, that's why I think if it goes to a jury trial, he'll be found guilty of something. Will it be what people think would be justice? Probably not the majority, but it will give that family some sort of peace in terms of ending the fact that the person that killed their child has been held accountable and responsible for his actions. Because I think at the end of the day, that's really what they're looking for. They're looking for somebody to be responsible. But I've always said, I don't just fault George Zimmerman for this. You stated in your opening about the amount of time it took them to even arrest him, and I find that to be the fault of the Sanford Police Department. So at the end of the day, when all this is said and done, whatever happens to George Zimmerman happens to George Zimmerman. But I think, you know, the back end of that, the Sanford Police Department needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, I understand your point. But at the same time, I think the intensity level of the O.J. Simpson trial and the intensity level of the trial, this George Zimmerman trial, will be at the same level. You know, and I'm not sure he's going to get a guilty verdict out of this. I'm not sure that he's going to be, you know, even looking at the bail, right? I mean, the judge set his bond at $150,000. That means he only had to pay 10% to get out, right? Which is already posted, and then they had to go through some precaution measures to make sure he, you know, is not harmed, and the ankle bracelet that he has is not being able to be hacked in, all those kind of things. But at the same time, it looks like to me that he's going to get off. I mean, I don't see no way around him being those charges sticking, second-degree murder charges sticking to George Zimmerman. And then not to mention all the legal support he has. The judge, his father, the judge just recused herself. I mean, the fact that his public defender is a high-priced lawyer. I mean, come on, Jimmy. He's going to get off.
I'm not gonna put that in the atmosphere. I disagree with that. I don't think he's going to get off. And by off, you mean he's not going to be, the charges won't stick in terms of murder two. I'm saying it may not be murder two, but he's going to get some time for something. It may not be what we want in terms of whether or not it'll be complete justice, but I don't think he's going to get off. I do agree. You know, I knew he would get bail. I just knew he would. I didn't think it would be so low. In my opinion, I thought $150,000 was a little low. I was looking for more around $500,000 to $1 million. Was what I was looking for, but I fought the prosecution on that. I don't think they came in, you know, in my opinion, strong enough. But, you know, this attorney allegedly is working pro bono at this time. He hasn't been nobody's paying him, so they say. And so we have to see how, you know, where that money trail is going to start and end at, excuse me, at the end of the day. But I agree with you that there's been a few things already that's been kind of suspect in this case. And so what it does is, for those of us in the African-American community, it once again gives us pause as it relates to the criminal justice system, because it doesn't seem to be fair when it comes to our justice. And so for that, I agree with you in that it's beginning to look a lot like everything else in terms of when dealing with people of color in the criminal justice system, like, oh, you know, that person, you know, gets off while another person, you know, gets 25 years for something. So I understand that part. I'm hoping that, you know, if that's not the case, but I'm pretty sure the majority of us are probably preparing for that. Because that's just what we expect. I mean, the hoopla around O.J. was not so much about O.J. as much as it was about, you know, couldn't believe that, you know, that they didn't find him guilty. And it wasn't that the evidence was that great. They, you know, we've seen people convicted with less. And so the fact that they didn't find him guilty was like, wow, you know, really? I just knew they was going to find him guilty. And so that was what the congratulations and the high fives and the cheers was all about, is, you know, wow, defense really does have a part to play in whether or not you win or lose. So I don't think this one will go down that way. I don't think people will react as we did back in the 90s. I don't think people will react violently or anything like that, because we haven't done it thus far. I mean, every protest, every movement has been peaceful. And people just want the family to have some closure more than anything.
Yeah, but I think that peace has been only because they you know, the evidence is overwhelming, and the fact that they know he did it, and they saying, okay, you know, how long are we going to have to wait before we take a stand, if you will? Because I believe right now, even you mentioned the prosecution didn't seem prepared when they went into this preliminary hearing over the last couple of days, and it seems to me that, you know, again, he, you know, his defense attorney got him off. I mean, you know, he played the I'm poor role. You know, he gave this half-cocked apology. You know, he's going through his checklist, and now all of a sudden he gets out. He's a free man on the street after killing a black man.
Did he get out? I mean, really, did he get out already? They already posted bond. They got everything
worked
out already.
The only thing they needed to do was to make sure that A, he was going to be safe, and then B, that they couldn't hack into his ankle bracelet. And so he's probably somewhere now chilling, watching the game in some undisclosed location, drinking margaritas.
And all of that very well may be true, but that is the criminal justice system as we know it. So, I mean, there are cases where people are given a bail. There's some where they're not. I mean, that's just the system that we have. So this isn't, This isn't new to the George Zimmerman case. This didn't just get instituted because of George Zimmerman. That's just the criminal justice system.
And that's why in my opening I said the American criminal justice system is a peculiar institution.
Oh, without a doubt. You get no argument from me on that.
The fact that that people are look at the crime as opposed to the charges associated to the crime. And that's why I'm really hampering on the fact that, yeah, we know he killed them, but he's charged with second-degree murder, which is going to be a tough and challenging thing to prove.
The only thing that the jury, if it ever goes to jury, will have to determine. I mean, manslaughter will come into that as well. So man one or man two or whatever. So that's why I'm saying he may not get the full however many years go with murder two, but he might get 5 to 10 with man two or whatever the number is for man one or man two. So it's not just they can't bring up they can't do anything around manslaughter. That's part of it. So that's the thing that's giving me hope is that it may not he made his final conviction, which as I stated, I do not think is gonna go to a jury, but I could be totally wrong about that. But when all the instructions are given and all the evidence is shown, he's gonna have to answer for a lot, and he doesn't have a whole lot there. I don't care how, and his attorney seems to be pretty astute, as well as he's a strategist. He's not, he says things with a smile, and usually when people talk like that, I'm a little suspect of them.
Okay.
Certain people that talk like that, I'm a little suspect of. So. He said some things over the last couple of days that's given me some pause about how shrewd he is as an attorney. So I sincerely hope that the prosecutors down in Florida are prepared and they come in much better than they did on Friday, which to all the legal experts that was talking about it, that they've never seen a bond hearing go like that one, that A, lasted that long and had that many people testifying, as well as George Zimmerman getting on the stand. All the legal experts were saying that was just completely, out of sorts in terms of how the process went. But not too many of them were surprised that he got bail, though.
You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. If you just tuned in, we're joined by the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer for TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Jima Hill Cook. And you can follow her on Twitter. And that's at AskJema, AskJema. Now, let's talk a little bit about this picture that came out this week, this bloody head vis-a-vis the bloody glove, like in the O.J. Simpson trial. Now, this bloody head is supposed to be something that proves that he was in a battle, right, with Trayvon, and he got his head bashed in. But if you ask me, if you look at the marks on his head, they're not consistent with what the story is. I mean, the picture shows this little trickle-down fake blood look like that somebody poured on his head that it has that runs down. I mean, it's not consistent with plain physics. I don't understand, how this is supposed to be, this overwhelming amount of evidence, of proof. What do you think?
Well, I agree, but more importantly, I'm more concerned about the person who took the picture and whether or not a layperson was allowed onto a crime scene to take a picture, which means, they could have, had some sort of impact on evidence. So here you have whoever's phone this was on. You have this picture, which miraculously appears the day he's ready to go to bond, to the day after he's arrested, and a week later he shows up in court, and now this picture comes out. I just find that to be all too odd and too convenient. But I would like to know who took the picture, when did they take the picture, where was the police if they took the picture on the scene, how did the police let them take the picture? I mean, because in my opinion, who should have been taking the picture was officers of the law, not lay people from down the street. And so if the picture is real, then who took it, who gave them the authority to take it, and what else did they take on the scene?
And
did they take items off the scene? I mean, now it's all suspect.
And did they move the body? You know, did they, you know,
right.
help clean out his hands? Did he,
right,
did
right.
he add the blood to
there
his
was,
head?
There, you know, there's some time lapse there between, and you know, I'm no private investigator, but I do watch a lot of stuff on TV. And looking, and I read a lot, and looking at the time stamp of the picture, something about that time doesn't quite fit into the time that everything else happened. So that's going to have to all be investigated as well. I mean, you know, I'm just a layperson, and I'm not saying I have the answers, but some stuff is pretty simple, and you can just look at it and tell they don't, you know, as you say, something in this milk ain't clean. And that picture is just, I'm not convinced it's authentic.
323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. Press 1 to talk, 2 to listen. Now, along those same lines about this picture, right? So he takes this picture of this guy's head, right? After he put the, it looks like he put the blood. I don't know if he put the blood on that. No, I'm just saying what it looks like to me. I mean, I know what Halloween makeup looks like, and that's what it looks like to me. Now, so after this potentially blood is on his head, he takes this picture. I don't understand how he didn't, take pictures of the, why would you be taking pictures of somebody's head out there at a crime scene? That is not normal behavior for people.
Correct. So it's almost like you trying to set up your defense before anybody even accuses you of anything.
Right, and then it means that, and that also means it was a witness on the scene.
Somewhere.
And so how is it that they, quote-unquote, question all the witnesses, and this guy is just now showing up?
Right.
And then, you know, and so if you're going to have a thorough investigation, you know, you're talking about and questioning everybody, and this guy obviously had close proximity to the house. Why either he lying, because if they question everybody, he didn't tell them about the picture, then something's wrong. Again, some of the milk ain't clean. This ain't right. I don't know what they're doing, but it doesn't seem fair.
That's why I said it goes back to, in my opinion, at the end of the day, the Sanford Police Department is as much guilty in this case as George Zimmerman, because of their inability to do their jobs and to do their jobs correctly and thoroughly. They allowed a lot of things to happen that should not have happened. Let's say this person was on the scene. This person did take a picture of the head. That's I'm sure that's not standard protocol for a police department to allow him to walk around as they did, and whatever attention they showed him in the car to the alleged wound, you know, where is that documented? You know, how did they send the second ambulance back? You know, told that second one not to come. Nobody performed CPR on the young man. I mean, there's a lot of questions about the actions of the Sanford Police Department. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, what Trayvon Martin's murder has exposed what is the ineptness of that Sanford Police Department, and that community has been dealing with that for years. So we know that this particular police chief was the third one in 3 years, and he had only been on the job for 8 months. So we know that there's a problem there, but it doesn't seem like they kept fixing the symptom. They were never really dealing with the problem. And so maybe now, with all this light, and once everything comes down the pike, Sanford Police Department, I'm hopeful, will still have to be dealt with. And maybe that's where the Justice Department would do its just due in terms of dealing with them. And I'm pretty sure at the end of the day, once the criminal trial is over with, I'm sure the family's going to sue the Sanford Police, because they had that boy in the morgue for 3 days before the family could go get him, before the family knew, before they even contacted, and yet they had all the parents' information. So there's a lot of things that happened after Trayvon was murdered that night that seemed suspect and seemed against protocol as it relates to law enforcement.
Yeah, because it seemed to me that, you know, just like the police was involved in the O.J. Simpson trial to kind of convict O.J., it seems to me that the police are involved in the Zimmerman case to kind of to brush this murder under the rug. I mean, so,
right.
You know, I'm not too sure that the police is somehow, you know, I don't know if they're involved, but it's something shaky about the police department. And it's all of a sudden this picture just come up, you know, out of the blue, and they don't talk about the picture of Trayvon and him helping Trey move the body. I mean, I don't know what happened, you know, during that time frame, but it doesn't It seemed like the police was involved somewhere, and I don't know where.
I agree with you on that, because I think based on some of the accounts from some of the people that had called the police that night and how they were basically pushed to the side when they were trying to give their accounts of the story, how they have their testimonies or their recounts were discounted by the police. I mean, you know, and for the police chief to come out, and the reason why this got all the attention is because the police chief came out and said they had no grounds to arrest him. So he was not going to be arrested. Well, that's when everybody was like, well, wait a minute now. How could he not be arrested? Nobody is saying he's guilty of anything. But you mean to tell me you don't have enough evidence to even arrest him? That's what caused the outrage, because the police chief made that statement, and that is when things got a little bit, you know, that's when everybody was up in arms. And so there in itself is why I say the police department is culpable for a whole lot of things. And had they just arrested him instead of coming out making that crazy statement, you know, we probably wouldn't be here because something else would have happened by now. But on the other side of that, I still think everything happens for a reason and nothing just happens for happens chance. And there's a reason that, you know, this young man, this family was chosen for this time. And so, you know, for those of us that believe in a power higher than ourselves, we have to trust that power knows exactly what it's doing.
Okay, so let me move to another issue right quick of the case. Now, it seems to me that George Zimmerman, committed perjury on the stand. Now, the bear hearing featured this dramatic testimony from Zimmerman, who took the stand and offered an apology. And he added he did not know how old Martin was and that he was unarmed. He said, and I quote, "I thought he was a little bit younger than I am." Now, we all heard the 911 tapes. We've all been told that was his voice on the phone. And he said that the dude looked like he was a teenager, in late teens. And now he says that he thought that he was a little bit younger. Isn't that perjury?
Well,
let me not use a clinical term. Wasn't he lying?
What we know is that it wasn't the truth, because based on the tape that he states he's in his late teens, because they asked that question. He said his late teens. Now, unless he, you know, late teens to him would be late teens is 18, 19, right?
That's
but
19.
But he's 28, so nowhere is 18, 19 close to my age, and I'm 28. So one, you know, there's not a lot of gray area there. I mean, you know, for all practical purposes, he was untruthful on the stand when he made that statement that he didn't know he was that young.
Okay, so why did the prosecution didn't jump all over?
What was the point, though? That wasn't, I mean, I've heard that, and initially I kind of felt the same way, but after I took a step back, the issue at this point wasn't about none of that. See, you don't want the prosecutor to show too much of their hand right now either.
Well, I mean, but that's a blatant lie. I mean, you could right away establish credibility.
Of course it's a blatant lie, and everybody in the room knew it was a blatant lie. But the issue was whether or not the prosecutor did what they needed to do to either have a high bail or no bail at all. And at the end of the day, they didn't convince the judge that he needed to stay in jail. They'd rather spend taxpayers' money with all these gadgets, having this security around him, and wherever he's going, because he's going out of state, wherever he ended up at, paying twice as much as they would probably pay to keep him in local jail. But let's not act like local jails is all that safe either, because we know people, you know, come up missing and or injured in jail as well. And to keep him in isolation for that entire time, you know, may not have been great, because, you know, he might have some sort of mental issue. So, I still go back to my original comment. Yes, he did tell a big bold-faced lie while he was on the stand, according to the recording of the 911 calls when he was asked by the dispatcher if he, you know, what was his age, and he said late teens, and yet on the stand on Friday he says he didn't know how old he was. He thought he was just a couple years younger than him. So, yes, that is a big, bold-faced lie, in yeah, layman's so, terms, he lied.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't go to Harvard Law, but my mama told me if you lie, you cheat, you cheat, you steal. And I think, you know, and he was, he could, they could have, the prosecution could have established that he was uncredible and that he would lie. And therefore, if you ask him, is he going to flee? And he says, yeah, he's not going to flee. That means he can, he's lying.
Right.
And so that's what you want to establish is credibility. And I don't think the prosecution did a great job in cross-examining the witness. We're going to go to the phone lines. The number to call is 323-580-5712. Again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're going to go to caller with 6962. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You have a comment or a question. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, my name is Kirk. I'm calling from Irving, Texas. How y'all doing?
Absolutely wonderful, Kirk.
Thank you. I wanted to make a couple of points about the case. Black men in America, all over America, are getting put in jail by the feds for conspiracy. And all it takes for that conspiracy is for you to either be associated with someone who's doing something illegal, or they have you on recording stating your intentions to go pick up dope or deliver dope or whatever. So I find it interesting that we have an undisputed 911 call who that laid out his intentions. I mean, his intentions were to profile this team. He said these fucking punks, according to them. I still say he said coons, but let's take the punks. He already put Trayvon in a box and then confronted him, and the confrontation led to him shooting Trayvon. Secondly, if he was a self-appointed neighborhood watchman, then they have codes and rules that they have to abide by. And if that's what he's calling himself, I find it real fishy that they haven't even approached him or censured him or turned their backs on him or anything from the law enforcement and the volunteer law enforcement side of it. You haven't seen anybody admonish him officially, even from these the neighborhood watch programs. So all I'm saying is that in the 911 tape, you see that they told him not to follow, and he disobeyed the order of the dispatcher, who is a police officer.
Yeah,
that right there put him in a criminal state. And also, just lastly, finishing up, in the state of Florida, during those arraignment hearings and bail hearings, the reason why the prosecution really didn't lay it out like that with them is probably because you can't cross-examine him in the next stage of trial unless he takes the stand. See, all they did was play the system so he could get that apology out. And I'll just end with that.
And thank you, Carla, for that. And I agree with that. I think because he had wanted to meet with the family and the family told him no, that they didn't want to meet with him before that. And so, which was well within their rights. I wouldn't want to meet with him either because, it's, you know, for what? You know, you've had all this time to issue an apology. You've been all on Facebook. You got your real George Zimmerman page up. You had all these surrogates out there that was talking for you before, those initial attorneys and then your brother and your friend. And none of them ever said he's sorry for what he's done. He's sorry to the family. Not one of them. And so now all of a sudden that you're in jail, now you want to say you're sorry? You've had 40-some-odd days to say you were sorry. And so I agree with the family for not, you know, wanting to meet with him. And that was what I was talking about when I was talking about his attorney and this showing you how shrewd he's going to be, because he made a point after the hearing during his press conference to mention the fact that they had tried to do that in private, but the family denied him his request. Like, you know, the family owed him something. And so just his language when he was talking, the attorney, when he was talking to the press, just his language lets me know, you know, what kind of game he's going to try to play. And his whole goal is to make George Zimmerman be, you know, for people to have sympathy for George Zimmerman. I mean, there was no other reason to have the father and the mother talking about their financial status like anybody really believes that. But anyway, and then the wife and you know, her situation, you know, bringing all these people in. But it was interesting. I don't think they brought the brother on the phone to talk. So I find that to be very interesting. He'd been doing a whole lot of talking prior, too. So, you know, it just seemed kind of weird that he got on the stand and gave that apology, which by all accounts was probably the worst apology. I mean, that was worse than any politician's apology for lying, you know, for being caught, you know, with another woman. So it ranked right up there with those. So I agree with that.
323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712. We're going to take another call. Last four, 2296. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Last four, 2296. Your mic is hot.
Hey, yes, this is Frank calling from Dallas, Texas. And just listening to the show. Want to call in and just kind of chime in a little bit on some of the points you guys were making.
All right, shoot, Frank. What you got?
Well, now I got a little criminal justice background myself, so want to share some very interesting points. One, in reference to the pictures, I do agree with the person that you have and that you're talking to in regards to the pictures, because we got to be careful about the chain of evidence, because we don't know whether those pictures are authentic and who took them and what led to the pictures being taken. Second of all, you got to also realize that whenever you're dealing with a bail hearing, the prosecution don't want to show too much of their hand. And so in order to probably restrict him from making the or being granted the bail, they'd have to show too much of their hand in their case. So bottom line, and I see that. But we also got to be careful. Although I do agree that he probably, guilty as hell, but we also have to make sure that he gets the due process that he deserves. But and people are up in arms about the fact that they charged him with second degree murder. But keep in mind that most of these cases are pleaded down anyway. So I think probably he may be looking at maybe a second degree manslaughter with a lot of other things attached to it, which may get his years up to hopefully 10, 15 years or something like that. And that's just me saying that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, like I said, you guys are making some real good points there, and just wanted to call in and say, hey, man, y'all doing a good job.
Well, Frank, we appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. We're going to take another call. Last four, 5122. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Carol from Dallas.
Hey, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Patrick. How are you guys doing?
Absolutely wonderful.
So I have a couple of comments really quick because I'm sitting here getting my nails done. just listening on the phone. Okay, so I wanted to kind of make a comment about not the last gentleman but the one prior to him who said that, you know, the operator told him not to pursue and he disobeyed, which is true. However, just so you guys know, that is not this, even though they're an employee of the police department, they're not like officially a police officer. So that is not like an order that you have to do. Like if a police officer tells you, you know, you got to do something, you got to do it. So it's a little different, just to make that distinction. Also wanted to talk about perjury. You guys were talking about he said that he thought the guy was older, closer to his age or whatever, and previously he had said clearly that Trayvon was a teenager. And so, Jima, you said, yeah, so what difference does it make? And so my only point there is, doesn't that kind of go to the credibility of his testimony, period, if he's perjuring himself on these little details, you know, doesn't that make somebody wonder how credible his testimony is, period, the end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I would suspect that he probably won't testify if it goes to a jury trial. I would suspect he probably wouldn't testify. I don't think we'll hear from George Zimmerman. I don't think we'll ever hear his voice again, honestly.
Right, and that was my point. I was hoping that the prosecution took that opportunity because they opened that door. They opened
right.
that door and says, look, you have an opportunity to pretty much ask me anything you want. And they did to a certain degree. But they had an opportunity to get him because they know when he goes to trial, they're not going to put him on the stand at all. Period.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a worst case scenario if he gets on the on the stand. And we know that that attorney is too good because he already baited them in the bail hearing. So you know he's going to bait them in actual trial. So it was an opportunity I think that the prosecution missed. And if I had to keep score, 1-0 to the defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't dispute that. Yeah, and I think the judge was, you know, I'm a little suspect about this judge, too, so we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys.
Well, thank you for
you.
Your call. So I want to ask another question, Gina, along those same lines. And, you know, he did get on the stand and he apologized, right? What do you make of the apology? And the fact that the attorney tried to pull them in and make the parents seem like they were unwilling to listen to his apology on behind the scenes.
Well, that was my point. You know, I think the attorney, you know, showed how shrewd he's going to be as an attorney, and that's what his job is. His job is to get his client off. So I can't begrudge him for that. But what we can't get caught up in is he's trying to. You know, he's appeasing to the parents and all of those things, when in reality, no, he's not. He's doing everything he can to get his client off. And so for him to backdoor and have George get up on the stand, and even the prosecutor even said, you know, you're not here. Was that a testimony? Because that was directed to the parents. That wasn't directed to everybody in the courtroom. You're apologizing to them. So even the prosecutor made mention of that. So when the attorney goes out after after the bail hearing, does his press conference, and then makes the statements, you know, well, we wanted to do that in private. The family, you know, did not honor his request. So we just wanted to get, he wanted to do that, and that was why. I mean, as if, as if the family owed him something. The family didn't owe him anything. They did not owe him that opportunity to apologize because, as I stated, he's had 46 days to apologize, and he didn't do it.
Yeah, you know, and the way that he did it, and then, you know, the lack of sincerity behind it, and then by him adding that piece, which really made me cringe, was the fact that he said, well, I didn't know he was, I thought he was my age. You know, I don't care how old he was, you don't go hunt somebody down and try to kill him.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean,
it's
so
right.
Just offering that up as an excuse, and then offering it, you know, right behind an apology, I think was disingenuous. And
right.
I think that it just goes to hit the malice that he has.
Right.
You know,
and that's exactly how the family felt. The family felt, you know, totally disrespected by Zimmerman and his attorney on Friday. Totally disrespected. As did the family's attorneys. I mean, the lady, Natalie, I can't think of her last name right now, the female attorney on the team, she was visibly upset. Afterwards during the press conference, I mean, visibly upset and felt highly disrespected during that process and felt like the family had been disrespected by him getting on the stand, making that lame apology.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's time for a quick break, and when we're going to keep the conversation going. Now, when we return, we're going to shift a little bit to this issue with, I don't know if you heard this or not, but this young 6-year-old was handcuffed and put into the back of a police officer's car. That's right. You heard me right. A 6-year-old, a little one in kindergarten, first grade, was handcuffed by the police and put into the back of a car. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Zimmer, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club
or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I wanted to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my East Bloom.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Iran says it's building a copy of a top-secret U.S. surveillance drone. Tehran captured the unmanned spy plane last year when it went down in Iranian territory. U.S. officials say security systems built into it prevent anyone from getting a hold of vital information. But an Iranian aerospace official today claims experts have recovered data that had been erased. He offered details about data he said had been extracted from the drone's recordings. U.S. officials say they're skeptical. The Obama administration says a Chinese company has sold parts for a missile transport system to North Korea. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports the sale is a violation of U.N. sanctions.
The Chinese firm is alleged to have sold the chassis for a missile transporter, which showed up last weekend in a military parade in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. At a House hearing Thursday, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said the ability to shuttle around intercontinental ballistic missiles only increases North Korea's threat to its neighbors. The White House does not believe the Chinese government knew about the sale, and the Chinese company may have thought the chassis was for civilian purposes. That said, the purchase appeared to highlight the continued difficulties of enforcing a UN ban on military sales to North Korea, a failing Stalinist state that routinely seeks to terrorize much of Northeast Asia with its nuclear program. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
French voters went to the polls today for the first round of their presidential election. Early results show President Nicolas Sarkozy coming in second to his socialist rival. A runoff is scheduled for May 6th. From Paris, NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports many French voters say Sarkozy has failed on the economic front, and he's not a nice guy either.
While Sarkozy supporters say the president has done a good job in steering the country through one of the worst economic crises in history, voter Yves Malon says Sarkozy only enlarged the gap between the rich and poor. So the question today, says Malon, is, do we want to continue in the same direction where always the same people bear the brunt of the economic downturn? This French presidential campaign has seen a huge anti-capitalist backlash, and socialist frontrunner François Hollande has tapped into a fear of the free market that has always held sway in France. Hollande proposes higher taxes on the super rich and says he will reduce inequalities. Sarkozy's personal style has also turned voters off. He is often described as aggressive, divisive, and unpresidential. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
A strategic pact between the U.S. and Afghanistan is reportedly back on track after a series of disagreements threatened to derail it. Top U.S. and Afghan officials finalized the document in Kabul today. The next step is for President Obama and Afghan President Hamid Karzai to sign it. The agreement provides guidelines for cooperation after most foreign forces leave Afghanistan in 2014. This is NPR News. You may or may not have noticed, but the average price of a gallon of gas has dropped. Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg says it fell 5 cents over the past 2 weeks.
What happened was crude oil prices stopped rising and were less volatile. So since there's plenty of gasoline on hand, finished gasoline, gasoline was able to tumble a nickel.
It's the first decline in the nationwide average since December. Today is the 42nd annual Earth Day. Celebrations are being held around the world, from Taiwan and Indonesia to, as NPR's Allison Keyes reports, Washington, D.C.
Even in a chilly rain in Washington, D.C., people turned out for an afternoon celebration of Earth Day on the National Mall. Activists, including Julia Martone Lefevre of the International Union of Conservation of Nature, asked the crowd to help protect the planet from the ravages of man.
Our extreme use and abuse of nature has wreaked havoc. Huge areas of forests have disappeared. Fisheries have collapsed.
Environmentalists rallied for Earth Day in Indonesia. Events were scheduled in San Francisco, Baton Rouge, and in New York's Times Square. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
If you have a desire to mark Earth Day in a brand new way, as of today, you can purchase a prize-winning light bulb that lasts for 20 years. You'll have to pay serious money for it. The suggested list price is $60. The LED, or light-emitting diodes bulb, is made by Dutch electronics giant Philips. The company won a Department of Energy competition to come up with an efficient alternative for the 60-watt incandescent bulb. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, here at Current Events, we're a big proponent of education. Now, unfortunately, every month this year, we have reported some questionable behavior by public officials, whether it be teachers, police officers, or politicians. In just a few minutes, we're going to bring up a local event that we wanted to draw your attention to. In fact, Dr. Lewis, our special guest for today, is going to fill us in on all the details. But first, I want to talk to you about an issue that I would consider to be very disturbing. Now, here's a story out of the Washington Post, and I don't know if you heard this or not, but a kindergartner who threw what they call a temper tantrum at her small town Georgia school was taken away in handcuffs, her arms behind her back, in an episode that is firing up the debate over whether teachers and police around the country are overreacting all too often when dealing with disruptive students. Now, the family of 6-year-old Celicia Johnson, six, I remind you, lashed out Tuesday over her treatment and said she was badly shaken while the school system and the police defended how they handled the episode. Now, some juvenile authorities say they believe it was happening more often, driven by zero tolerance policies and an increased police presence on school grounds over the past 2 decades because of tragedies like the Columbine High massacre in Colorado. Hard numbers to back up the assertion are difficult to come by. Kids are being arrested for being kids, says Shannon Kennedy, civil rights attorney, who is suing the Albuquerque, New Mexico school district, where hundreds of kids have been arrested in the past few years for minor offenses, including such things as having cell phones in class, burping, refusing to switch seats, and destroying a history book. Now, in 2010, a 14-year-old boy was arrested for inflating a condom in class. Arrested for it. Now, in Georgia, Shalisha was accused of tearing items off the wall and throwing books and toys in an outburst Friday at the Creekside Elementary in Midgeville, a city of about 18,000, some 90 miles from Atlanta, police said. Authorities said she also threw a small shelf that struck the principal in the leg and jumped on a paper shredder and tried to break a glass frame. Police refused to say what set off the tantrum. The school called police, and when an officer tried to calm the child in the principal's office, she resisted, authorities said. She then was handcuffed and taken away in a patrol car. Handcuffed. Six. I don't get it. I need you to weigh in on this. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712. Jima, now this is your line of expertise. Out of many, I may add, what is going on here?
Well, I have to admit that I agree with the column you wrote in terms of the zero policy and zero tolerance has just been taken a tad bit overboard because we are now charging kids with crimes that back in our day was not considered crimes. So we're feeding a system and placing them into a system that only continues to breed and grow, and that's the criminal justice system. So we are spending a lot of money on that end and not a lot of money on our education end, and thus is why we have the problem. So I don't know what a six-year-old could have done in that instance at school. She didn't have a weapon. I mean, she didn't have anything but her body, I'm presuming. So I'm not sure what she was doing that caused so much concern for everybody else's safety, all these adults in the room, because they didn't call the parent. There were so many things they didn't do in this instance that would have them handcuff her, put her in a police car, and take her to the adult jail where she sat for a couple hours in an adult jail cell.
And this kid has to be
a violation of her civil rights. I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be traumatic for a little six-year-old child.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then all the charges they had suspended her for the rest of the year and charged her. She had like three felony counts.
Yeah.
You know, that they had originally charged her with, which have all been dropped. And, you know, they've even stated she can come back to school there. But, of course, the family is like, no, she won't. You know, she's been completely traumatized at this point. And I can understand that. I mean, I have a five-year-old, and if they were to say my son was that out of control, why ain't nobody calling me? And according to the family, they were on the Al Sharpton show on Friday, on his radio show, they stated that they have four numbers of emergency contacts, four, you know, listed for somebody to be called. And they didn't call anyone until after the girl had already been taken off of the school ground. So they didn't even call anybody when everything got started. You know, they get a hold of an aunt later.
So when did the shift take place, though? I mean, we've been playing practical jokes. We've been skipping school. I mean, we've done a lot of interesting things over the last three, four decades. And they never were seen to be criminal. When did they take a shift to criminal, these behaviors?
Well, I mean, you have to go back to the 90s. And 90s under Bill Clinton, when he signed his juvenile crime bill in 1992, I believe, when he signed that law, when they began to be able to certify juveniles as adults and could try them as adults as young as 13. And then some states could even be tougher and try them as young as 12, depending on the crime and things of that nature. So it all goes back to that point, that whole get tough on crime, when allegedly they say juvenile crime rate was high, and so they wanted to find ways to eliminate and bring the crime rate down. Well, some of the things that he instituted were good. I can't say they were all bad, because it did give some additional funding to programs and to systems to be able to try deferment programs before kids actually ended up getting into the system. But then, you know, as with all things, when the money runs up, then there's nothing to sustain those things that you once implemented. And so along with all of that, so the whole get tough on crime, somebody somewhere, whoever the genius was, and I say that facetiously, but whoever the genius was that said, you know, not only should we have zero tolerance as it relates to drugs, but we should have zero tolerance as it relates to behavior. And so now we label kids, and now we arrest kids as opposed to finding out what's wrong with the kids and treating the kid. We're not treating anything anymore. We're just labeling it and giving it a title and then sending it on somewhere else to be dealt with.
Okay. I can appreciate that. But is it the case that a six-year-old child can get out of hand? I mean, is it the case that you cannot, as an adult, as a group of adults, cannot control a six-year-old child?
You should be able to control a six-year-old child. And once again, reiterate exactly what it was they said she did in her class.
Okay.
They said she broke something.
Yeah, so they said that she was a sit up by the legs. She jumped on a paper shredder, and she threw a small shelf that struck the principal in the leg and tried to break a glass frame. She was tearing items off the wall and throwing books and toys in an outburst.
Hmm. And what you don't get there, and is what the family stated, is that she had been being bullied by some of her classmates that
day. Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And so, as we all do, we get to the boiling point. We flee. It's called flight or fright. We flee or we fight. And so she chose to fight. And so, I'm not saying her behavior was okay. I'm saying I understand it. That doesn't mean there's not consequences for it, because even with my own child, when he decides he wants to act up, there's consequences for that behavior. So we still have
absolutely.
To teach her that there's consequences for your behavior, but the consequences of her being handcuffed to the point that the handcuffs broke her skin. That's how tight they put the handcuffs on her, according to the family.
That
the handcuffs broke her skin, and so to the point that she's handcuffed and placed in the back of a car, I'm not sure that is the consequence that would have been needed. And so, you know, we have to get to, you know, I'm sure the educators out there are going to talk about what all happens in the classroom, and there's too many kids in there, and there's a lot going on, and they're doing more than teaching. I get all of that. I have nothing but the utmost respect for those that are in the classroom. But on the flip side of that, you have to manage all of that. I mean, you're in the classroom, so you have to manage all of that. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's something that I could do. But have we become a society where we handcuff six-year-olds for having a tantrum, which is something that six-year-olds do? Six-year-olds have tantrums.
I just can't see, not being able to control a six-year-old. I don't care how
right.
big, large, or what the circumstances are. I mean, because at some point you should be able to isolate them and put them in a situation until they calm down. I mean, if they go in a room somewhere with a parent where they don't have anything, they're eventually going to calm down. I mean, so there are other strategies, you know, other than calling the police. I mean, you know, going to the office, I can understand. And then the assistant principal, the counselors, all these people are supposed to be involved. And supposed to, you know, try go down their steps, their methods of trying to control this behavior. I just don't see a reason at any point during this process where you have to call the police for a six-year-old. Just don't see it.
Right.
And so,
I totally agree with you. Totally agree.
And so I just don't understand, you know, why they would go to the extreme measures to do that. So I wonder, you know, I wonder if there are some statistics on how behaviors have changed since they stopped paddling, right? I don't know if you may not be old enough to know when they used to get paddled in school. But I used to get paddled in school either, when I go to the assistant principal's office, or even in my classroom when I was in middle school. I mean, I used to get my little hand and he used to pop me in with the ruler in the hand, and it would mm-hmm. alter my behavior. But at the same time, you had a lot more respectable, the behavior of children were a lot different then than now. So some would seem to suggest that, of course, the behavior of the kids are out of control these days, and so they would consider this kind of normal behavior to call the police. I don't care how old they are. I just don't agree with that.
I don't agree with that. And even if you do call the police, you don't handcuff a 6-year-old, place her in the back of the police car, and take her to adult jail. I mean, all of that. I mean, everything after calling the police, I find to be disheartening. So you do call the police. You're telling me the only thing they can do is handcuff her, place her in the police car, take her on a ride to the nearest police station, and wait in an adult jail cell? That's the best you can offer a 6-year-old. That's all you can offer a 6-year-old. I mean, to me, that's wherever this place is, they got a whole lot more problems than that.
Oh, yeah. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712. In about 15 minutes, we're going to bring on Dr. Lewis. But before we do that, I want to ask you, I want to shift gears one more time to this runaway, this Bronco situation we had here in Dallas over the other day. So, Jimmy, I want you to describe the situation as you remember, recall the events as you remember them of this high-speed chase in Dallas the other day.
Well, I got in and I turned on television, and there on the news there was this police chase going down here in the Dallas area off I-30. They were chasing behind this red Ford Explorer, and so I was watching it and trying to figure out, okay, what is going on? You know, what happened? And so I was listening to it, listening to the reporters trying to give us some information about, you know, the young man in the car, and what they thought was happening is that, you know, he had allegedly the day before had got into it with a girlfriend or someone, and so they were coming by that particular day to serve him with some papers, I guess. And so he just decided to kidnap her. That's the story. And they went off on this joyride, basically up I-30 around the city. And reportedly a couple of times, I mean, the majority of the time that he was in this chase going up I-30 and back again, and then came back around, headed back to downtown, he was reportedly on the phone with the Mesquite Police Department, basically letting them know that he did not have a weapon. So that's probably why they never did shoot at the car or try to block it or anything, because the alleged kidnapped victim wasn't under any distress, which I saw her smoking and flip a cigarette out. Excuse me, flip a cigarette out the window, so she couldn't have been too distressed. But anyway, and then there was several times he was driving and he would have his hand out the window like he was waving at everybody, because, you know, he had all three channels on lockdown, you know, so with nothing else coming on until this. And this went on for a good hour, you know, from about 11:45 to right around 1 o'clock or so is when he finally decided to just stop. You know, he got downtown and pulled in front of the convention center or somewhere down there. And, he literally hopped out the car and laid down on the ground and took his hat off his head, basically letting them know, do not shoot. You know, I'm unarmed. I don't have nothing on me. I'm just going to lay down here on the ground. And that's exactly what he did. And then they went and got the person out of the passenger seat and took her to the car. But it was something to watch, because I was like, what happened that he feels like he needs to, A, he's in this Explorer, and, you know, gas ain't cheap for nobody's vehicle right about now. So I'm trying to figure out, where is he going, and why did he pick, you know, this time of day to just decide to go on his joyride and take Dallas City Police on such a chase from one end all the way around and back again. So
okay,
it was entertaining.
I'm going to say it's probably the smartest police chase I've ever heard of or seen for that matter, because he understands that for the last decade, black men have been killed unarmed, right? Every scenario you come up with, I'm sure in his mind, he's saying, look, all the scenarios, they all go wrong. So I am going to do whatever I can to draw as much attention, you know, to this particular situation that I can. I want helicopters on me. I want spotlights. I want Batman. I want everybody looking at me and seeing what I'm doing. And then he gets to the point where he calls the police and he briefs them. Look, I don't have anything. I'm going to surrender. I'm going to show you my left hand. I'm going to show you my right hand. I got a cell phone. I don't have anything. I mean, he kind of walked them through the situation. And it's reported that they talked to him and said, look, here's what you do when you stop the vehicle. You get out, you lay down. So he wanted his life. And, you know, and it's sad, A, that he broke the law, but it's sadder that the fact that he had to take those precautionary measures for a simple routine arrest. Sad.
Yeah, extremely.
And you know, and I can kind of sympathize with his behavior. You know, hopefully he don't go out and break the law the way he had to put himself in that situation again. But the fact that he did not trust the police to come and do what they're going to do just to arrest him. I mean, too many cases that you've heard of that police just shooting unarmed people, especially black men, for no reason. You know,
right.
Again, I had to applaud the man, 110%.
It was quite amazing to watch, you know, to see how it all unfolded. Him slowing down, you know, once he got in the residential area and he slowed down, he had his signals on as he was turning. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I was like, he has to be the most cautious driver in a high-speed chase that I've ever seen in my life, all on the highway and you know, so... So maybe because he had been on the phone with Mesquite police and maybe they were relaying things back to the envoy that was following behind him that, that they decided, you know, not to shoot the tires out or do any sort of major maneuvers on the highway.
All right, we're going to take another break. And when we return, we're going to bring on Dr. Monica Lewis. That's right. Now, Dr. Lewis and our family moved to Colorado Springs in 2002. After teaching and managing a volunteer program and working in both the public and private sector, she began to realize that her passion was to see students excel through education and community service. She and her family relocated in Cedar Hill, Texas in 2007. And in 2009, she and her husband, James, opened their own private school, Nehemiah Christian Academy, to service the Cedar Hill Tri-City community and homeschool students online. Dr. Lewis is married to James Lewis Jr. He's the CEO of their company. They have 6 children, 2 of which reside with them in Cedar Hill, Texas, Tyrese and Ajene. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Seema, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my equal.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be having Dr. Lewis join us. And she's going to be telling us about this incident that happened here within the Dallas metro area. And so, again, Dr. Lewis and her family moved to Colorado Springs, moved from Colorado Springs in 2002 after teaching and managing a volunteering program and working in both the public and private sector. She began to realize that her passion was to see students excel through education and community service. She and her family relocated to Cedar Hill, Texas in 2007. In 2009, she and her husband, James, opened their own private school, Nehemiah Christian Academy, to service the Cedar Hill Tri-City community and homeschool students online. Dr. Lewis is married to James O. Lewis, Jr. He's the CEO of their company. They have six children, two of which reside with them in Cedar Hill, Texas, Tyrese and Ajanae. Now, after teaching in the public school system, she says she's realized that even though all students do not learn the same, they can learn. Through quality instruction, individualized, self-directed learning, and students learning at their own pace can restore students' dignity, honor, and self-respect for learning. By teaching to the students cognitively and not to the test, restores their self-esteem and their ability to learn and service their community. Through these concepts, you will see them SOAR, and that it stands for Students of Academic Restoration. Dr. Lewis?
Yes, how are you there, Professor Cook?
Absolutely wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, first and foremost, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of lay the groundwork. Give us a little backstory of the situation and what happened, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay. Well, February 13th, our daughter Ajanae was in her eighth period math class, and she and another young lady had their phone out on their desk, and teacher asked them to put it up. I guess they didn't put it up in a timely fashion, as far as he felt like. He struck the other young lady in the back of her head with an open hand, struck Ajanae on the side of her head with an open hand. The other young lady ran out the room, called her parents. Ajanae stayed, asked why he did it. He took it as a point to stand in front of the class and explain his behavior. And that's pretty much it. And we've been trying to get the district and the school to just give us due process.
So, you know, a lot
take care of doing an interview, you know, the whole, what should be done, basically, is due process.
You know, it's hard to imagine that, you know, that a teacher putting their hands on a child these days. Now, I brought up earlier during the show about going back and getting paddling. That was a form of discipline. But to walk up and just hit somebody upside their head, that's not normal. So what was the process after you got the facts? What steps did you take?
We contacted her assistant principal, who is the disciplinary principal, and we found out in charge of the math department, because it was a math teacher. Told him about the incident. Ajanae went down. She and the other young lady did statements. We had a phone call from the principal indicating she was aware of the situation. She felt it was best to take the students out of the classroom. She was handling an investigation, and the teacher was out of the classroom, out of the building, off campus until the investigation was complete, which did not happen. And mind you, Ajanae stayed in the classroom. The other young lady's parents came down and was very irate, was moved immediately out of class. Ajanae stayed in the classroom for another 2 to 3 days until I contacted her counselor and had her get on the case and transfer her out of class.
Wow.
So that's pretty much it. There was another situation where something was stolen from her the Friday after that happened, so we went down, had to do another report with the police on campus. They were not aware that the incident had even occurred. We're not aware of anything about an investigation that wasn't followed up either. So, I mean, you know, it's really been a process there, Professor Cook, a real process.
So have you been able to get any type of support through the system at all?
No, you know, they did their little fuzzy-wuzzy, you know, calm and soothe the parent down. We had to contact the district. Their operations manager, Kim Lewis, contacted us back, set up a meeting. He was very, very quick to respond with, you know, come in, let's talk about it. Just did the soothing little, I'm sorry it happened, something should be done immediately. And mind you, the process, after I did my research, the process in Cedar Hill Independent School District, as well as TEA, which is Texas Education Agency, is that statements should be taken. Statements should be taken from the person that's been assaulted. Statements should be taken from any witnesses in the classroom. And CPS is supposed to be called. CPS was not called. As far as interviewing any students, the whole investigation process was tainted because the teacher's wife is a sub. He was out at a baseball tournament, and the wife was the sub during the time that he was out the building. So, of course, you know, she scared all of the students, or, you know, really just put them under duress, made it a hostile environment where nobody really even wanted to speak. So the whole due process was tainted is what our issue is. So, you know, they're just trying to cover it up or whatever, and it's just, I don't know, it's even frustrating to talk about it. I apologize.
No, I understand it. And so we're just, you know, hopefully, you know, what could the community do to help you, you know, get some traction on this case?
Well, we've started a petition on change.org talking about when educators, when administrators and teachers cross the line in education, and we're actually asking for the principal, Tammy Mariani, and the teacher, Jonathan Mullins, to resign. When you're an educator, your main goal is not only to educate, but at all costs, to be about the safety of the student, which has not happened. The other interesting thing about Ms. Mariani, the principal, is that she is a counselor by design. So therefore, the first thing to me as an educator that should have came on, the light bulb that should have come on, was for her to look out for the safety and the best interests of our child, and she did not do that. So she shouldn't be able to do the job if she's not going to make sure that a student is safe. So we're doing that, and you can go on change.org, sign a petition. We're looking for 2 million signatures, 300,000 will get us national attention, which we're praying for. And we've started a protest. We've called, this happened back in February. This is 2 months, almost 3 months down the road. School ends in 20 days, 20 school days. We still haven't gotten anything done. We started to protest. We went out on Thursday. We'll be out every day, if need be, until somebody hear our cry that you cannot treat students, you cannot assault students, and parents have rights.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you on that. So, you know, best case scenario for you, what would be the steps that you think needs to happen from this point forward? If everything started and was the ball got rolling, what would be those steps that would take place for you?
What I think should have happened is there should have been a conversation, not only with the district, if the principal was a seasoned principal, and I hope that there are some principals online to let me know if I'm in line or out of line, but I think there should have been a conversation with the teacher as well as the principal, counselors, and ourselves in Ajene regarding the situation. And the one thing that I asked Professor Cook was, did he apologize? That's the first thing I asked Ajene the next day. Did he apologize? There was no apology. So, you know, from here to me, apology is really unacceptable. My husband has stated that to the district. I mean, it's gone on for too long. And for you to be able to just think that you're going to just cover this up, and there's been more than one instance of this happening to a child where it's been covered up. Once again, parents do not know their rights. They know that if we just not say anything at all, Patrick, that we'll eventually go away. But because we are educators and we know our rights, we're not going away. You're going to give us due process. So a conversation should have happened. We should have talked about what was right, what was wrong. We understand Ajene shouldn't have had her phone out. But at no point should you think that you have the right to put your hands on a child. And our main focus on this, Patrick, is really due process. The investigation should have happened beyond CPS. The campus, it should have happened. None of that has happened. So, and that's really the issue. And we don't want to make it a black-white issue. I do want to put this out there, that the teacher is white, a white male. Mm-hmm. Secondly, married to an African-American female. And he needs to understand that you do not have a black past because you have a black wife to hit black kids.
Mm.
That's unacceptable beyond being an educator.
So let's say hypothetically that nothing happens and school is out. Now they're on a break. What steps can you take at that point in time?
We contact the TEA, which is Texas Education Agency. They ask us to be a part of the next board meeting, put it on the agenda. We're going to do that. We've asked for another meeting with the superintendent. That hasn't happened yet. We've asked for that about 2 weeks ago. That hasn't happened yet. So, and then we can file a grievance. So we're going to put all of those steps in process, but we're actually going to go outside of that as well, because at the end of the day, Patrick, she's been assaulted. So we are going to go to the police department and the district attorney's office and actually see if we can file press charges against him. And I'm also looking at having this principal's counseling license revoked.
323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. We're going to go to the phone lines right now. All right, caller, last 4-9914. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, Patrick. My name is James Lewis.
Hey, Mr. Lewis, how are you?
All right. I'm the father of Ajene Latimer, and that's my beautiful wife, Dr. Monica Lewis, on the line as well.
All right. So you have a comment or a question?
Well, no, you don't have a comment. You know, basically what I'm doing is that, you know, throughout my whole life, I have always taught my kids to do the right thing and follow the procedure of the law. You know, for myself, it's been a hard situation because I had never wanted anybody to assault one of my kids. You know, it's been to the point where, you know, I wanted to go up there and do some things, but then again, I would lose in the long run because what would happen is I would lose my license to be able to do what I'm doing already as far as doing my school,
I'll
be banned from school property. And so what I'm going to do from now on is be in their face every day. We're going to be out there protesting, good weather, bad weather. We're going to be out there with our signs because something changes.
Awesome. As Monica talked a little bit about the steps she's taken, what about you? What actions have you been involved in, and what are your expectations?
Well, my expectations were at first, you know, for us to basically just to receive an apology, but that never happened. Now we have to go to the extreme. resignation of Tammy Mariani and Mr. Mullins to, you know, to resign from their positions and for us to move forward from there.
Awesome. So, Dr. Lewis, let's go back to you now for a second. You stated earlier the petition that you have online and the fact that you're going to go to the board. Is there something that the all the listeners out there they can participate in as well? Or how can they support you?
Patrick, there is. If we have listeners on the phone that are in the Tri-City, City Hill, Duncanville, DeSoto area, even Dallas area that would like to come out and assist us in protesting, we should be out there about 7:30 in the morning. You can see any updates that we have on our website. Well, it's not a website, but it's on change.org on the petition. We do updates to the petition, as well as there's a Facebook page regarding stopping assault in education with administrators and teachers. So we do a lot of updating there. Like I said, you can go to the website, change.org, sign the petition so we can get some information out there, try to get some national attention. It's just not a Cedar Hill or a Texas issue. I have parents texting me, emailing me all the time, hitting me on Facebook saying they've had these same instances, no one's done anything about it. So it's a nationwide issue, Patrick. And we have to, as parents, know our rights, stand up for what's right, and stop being scared to talk. I mean, we're in 2012, and we're still acting like, I hate to say, but we're still acting like, I mean, we're on a plantation. We know what's right. I mean, we'll stand up for everything else, and, you know, Atlanta Housewives, and I'm sorry for the fans and all of that, the reality TV and whole nine, but when it's about what's right and when it's about education and how your child is being educated and treated by someone who considers themselves a professional, we don't want to talk about it. You'd be amazed at how we were standing out there on Thursday. Parents looked at the signs, and they were just driving by like, oh, we don't want to touch that. How dare you? I mean, that is so sad to me. This is public education. You are paying these people to educate and secure the safety of your child 6 to 8 hours a day. And mind you, he's also, Mr. Mullins is also a coach. So there's a stigma there as well where coaches, and maybe you need to do another show on that, but there's a stigma there as well where coaches feel like they have this feeling or this air about them that they can put their hands on kids and get away with it as well. And it's just not right.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Let's shift now to Ajene. How is she doing? How is she feeling? How are things going with her?
Well, Ajene is actually a trooper. When she came home and told us about it, one thing I do thank God for, us not only being in education but having a school and her being allowed to see how it's ran and as far as the administrative procedures of it and the education and the teaching aspect of it. And the first thing that she said was, he's a great teacher. He just crossed the line. So it wasn't like it was a personal vendetta. She hated him. She wanted to get out of his classroom, any of that. She just knew that as a professional, he crossed the line. The second thing that really disturbed me while we knew we had to take this a step further, me being a four-time survivor of domestic violence, Patrick, she had all the symptoms of becoming a victim of domestic violence. She was very despondent. She started staying to herself. She did, I knew it's all my fault. I shouldn't talk about it. All of those things. And that's what really sparked for me that at 17 years old, that not from her parents, not from anyone else, that she has the symptoms of being victimized by domestic violence by the hands of someone else. And we can't tolerate that. That is of zero tolerance in our family. That should be of zero tolerance in any household. So
yeah.
She's doing well. She's A's and B's. She's still on honor roll. She's taken the situation and used the fuel from it as a positive instead of a negative. So move forward with her studies, her academic studies. So we're really excited about that. And we just had to really keep her grounded. We had to have her encouraged, through family and friends. and just really stay prayed up about it, that she would turn her mindset to say, you know, this isn't right, and we have to stand for what's right. And since we've protested, she's had a lot of support from students. We didn't go out on Friday because of the weather, and they were actually looking for us.
Wow.
Which I thought was a good thing.
So for the listening audience out there, a lot of times they say, well, you know, kids, they have behavior problems. They're not doing all that well in school. Their grades must be bad. But I think we can dispel that notion about this particular instance, right? I mean, Ajene is a pretty model student. Talk a little bit about the classes she's taking in her grades.
Ajene has been on honor roll since elementary school, 3.5 grade point average. Her father and I pulled her disciplinary records while we were at school to gather our case. Does not have anything disciplinary in her record. She's in the top 25% of her class. She's pretty much scholarship bound and could pretty much get into any school that she wants to. Has the desires to be a chemist and a fashion designer to start her own fashion and makeup line.
Wow.
To be her own little entrepreneur. So this isn't, I hate to say, the possible 6-year-old that's been handcuffed.
Right.
Her father, biological, and her stepfather are military, ex-military. So she comes from a very stern, very firm household. And those that know me as well as yourself and anyone that's on the line know that we have zero tolerance. So that's not even the case. This is not a lack of parenting, lack of academics, lack of behavior. This is just not right.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make sure to make that clear to the listening audience out there, because sometimes people think that, you know, just because a teacher, you know, gets in a confrontation with a student, it's sometimes the student provokes it. But it looks like in this case, she did violate one of the school policies. But, I mean, the punishment, if you will, didn't fit the crime, if you will. So. In this particular instance, it seems like there is definitely cause to be alarmed and cause for inquiry in a particular situation like this, because if the teacher goes about this behavior with this particular student with ease, and the fact that I heard it was two people as opposed to one, then this obviously couldn't be the first time or the first incident that he felt comfortable striking students, if you will. Has there any other cases in his history been brought up or and looked at?
Well, he's actually a teacher that's transferred from DISD, which is Dallas Independent School District. I've talked to some other educators, and I mean, this is just hearsay, so you know, I can't say it's concrete and accurate, but there has been some cockiness, some other instances, some actual possible inappropriate behaviors that I cannot confirm or deny, but there's been some things that have been looked at from my understanding. And as far as policy and procedure, Cedar Hill Independent School District policy says that because it's an AP class and it's math, that they can, with the teacher's permission, have their phones out because they're smartphones. So we cannot say that she did not have it out to use it for a calculator.
Mm.
Now, because we have not talked to him or no one at the school or the district will clarify if this is policy in his classroom, we don't know. We just don't know. But it is stated in the school book policy.
So has there been any type of investigation at all that would kind of give you insight on what the cause of the situation was?
Not at all. Contacted Police Chief Collier for the school district. He was not aware of the situation when we contacted him 2 weeks ago to ask him for a copy of the report so we could move further outside the school police. He wasn't aware of it at all. We've constantly called him every day, every other day. Oh, I thought they've gotten that information to you. Let me give you a call back. He never does.
So it seems like to me there's no dispute that it happened. It seems to me that they're talking about the due process or the actual repercussions of it happening that hasn't been addressed.
Correct.
Wow. So, I mean, I guess the obvious question, and I'm sure the listening audience out there want to know is, well, it seems like you try to talk to the school. And then the next line of defense, if you will, for the parent is the school board. Have you contacted anybody at the school board? And if so, what was their response?
Vice president of the school board, Sonya Grass, is she and I sit on a board together with the choir, and I informally let her know what happened. She indicated via email that she contacted Horace Williams, who is the superintendent of Cedar Hill Independent School District, and he was aware. I emailed her back and asked, was there any findings, anything regarding the investigation, and she indicated that, to her understanding, it was still being investigated. So I did contact CPS, the representative who was handling the case, once I contacted them about it, and she indicated that based on their definition of assault, that there were no findings. But after further research into that, it is to my understanding that CPS really doesn't get involved unless there's sexual assault, where they would dig further into whether it actually happened or not. They would really want the campus or the school district to handle it.
Wow.
So the next step is to go before the board in an open meeting and be a part of their agenda.
So what about a copy of all these investigations? Have you received any copy of the things that has taken place? Even if it's just an inquiry,
no,
asking questions.
Not at all. I have asked for a, if parents do not know, there's such thing as a open records report that you can ask for from the district that has anything that your child has been involved with in the school district, any pictures, any comments, any disciplinary, any projects, anything that they've been involved in. And so we've asked for that, and we're waiting on that. And it, to me, they're kind of stalling that as well. But we have asked for that to see if there's anything else in her file beyond when we pulled it a month ago and if they have properly dialogued this incident that occurred, because it should be a part of public record where anyone should be able to go get it to news media, anyone such as yourself with your show that wanted to talk about it or discuss it. So we want to see if that has happened as well. But we do have copies of Ajene and the young lady's statement that
wow.
they made, and we do, you know, have proof that that Ms. Tamariani did indicate that there was an investigation going on and the teacher was out of the classroom until the investigation was complete, and that has not happened. He has been at his job capacity since day one, educating and as a coach, as well as his wife.
Wow. So when is the board meeting, and what is your course of action during the board meeting? Are you going to You said you're going to probably be on the agenda, but what are you going to actually do and talk about and say? What's the intent there?
I believe the next board meeting is May 7th. I can clarify that if that's something you want to put on your website. And basically, we want to talk about parents' rights and due process and why wasn't it taken care of. I mean, that's the main point. I mean, we really don't want to make it racial, and we also want to talk about why is it that you can get something done if you're irate and ignorant versus trying to handle it indecent and in order, as James and I have as her parents. You know, I think the one thing about, to get off the subject for just a second, but the one thing about the Trayvon Martin incident, and I believe I may have stated this before in a previous talk show of yours, they have been so eloquent being parents and have lost a child. They have not been irate. They have not gone out in protest and been indignant. They have handled this with so much eloquence. And I think this is the issue with parents, why we can't get anything done and why we may even be ignored, because we're not being ignorant. And we refuse to be ignorant. My husband and I, we refuse to go to that level. We refuse to get out of the protest, start screaming and yelling. It's unnecessary. That you, because you're acting like a human being should act, that you get ignored. But when you don't, that you get all the attention in the world. And we have to change that mindset.
All right, let me bring James back on the line for a minute. James, any comments? James, you still with us?
Hold on a minute there, Pat.
Okay. All right, we're going to go to the phone lines. We got a caller, last 4-8-3-8-5. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from. Last 4-8-3-8-5. Your mic is hot. Okay. Well, we're wrapping up. We're getting down to the end of our show here, and we're gonna give you your final comments, please.
Well, I think as we close out with the case with Monica and James and their daughter, it is important to remember, you know, the due process, and I think that's what she's looking for. And then in due process, there's timelines for everything, and so you know as they are preparing and moving forward, having sat on the other side of the table, I know sometimes people in positions of authority tend to string things along and make it more difficult for the person on the other side to get resolution, because then they say you've run out of time. So it's important that we stay vigilant and we stay on top of everything, and we don't allow our emotions to override, you know, what it is we're trying to accomplish. And it appears as though the Lewises have maintained that throughout this whole process. And probably, you know, a lot of things are happening legally around the world, around the United States, and it seems odd that it seems like it's all happening all at one time. You can't turn on the news without hearing of some other sad story. We didn't get to touch on this today, but maybe next week we can talk about the lady down in Florida that's looking at 25 years for not even killing somebody, but I think she just shot her gun off and she was a victim of domestic violence. And so, you know, what is that all about? You know, and Florida, once again, will probably be the pivotal state in this election. And yet it's one of the ones that has implemented some pretty harsh voter suppression laws in that state. And so, as you know, we've talked about voter suppression this entire year. And as we're getting closer now and more states are having primaries, you're finding out whether or not you have your voter registration cards and what those rules are. Find out now. Go participate. Call your local people to make sure that your name is on the roll, because you do not want to get to November and not be able to vote, because a lot is depending upon your vote. And do not be convinced that your vote doesn't matter, because it does. Do not be fooled to think that this race is over already on either side. They'll convince you that either that the president has in the bag or the president is going to get beat. Either way, their intent is to keep you from voting. And I say show up and vote regardless of what the poll numbers say. And just stay engaged, as you say every Sunday, stay engaged and stay informed, because it's being informed is how you get to participate in the process and make those changes that we need to make.
All right. Dr. Lewis, any final comments?
You know, I just want to say that parents, we need to take back our kids. We need to stop letting the schools and the school districts raise them. It is our job, not theirs. I know it's hard working, trying to survive in this recession, but it's our responsibility and not theirs. So let's take back what's ours. Do what's right.
Awesome. Again, that's at change.org and your Facebook page?
It's Stop Assault in Education with Teachers and Administrators.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to Dr. Lewis and her husband, James Lewis. And I would be remiss if I didn't give a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent, Jima Hill Cook. Now, don't forget to follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJema, AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. And don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Take us away, Joyce.